Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 9 a.m., January 19th, 2022. I'm joined today by my co-chair, Senator Bishop, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Wilson. Senator Hoffman may not be here today, but he's also a committee member. And myself, Senator Stedman. I'd like to welcome everybody and staff to the Finance Committee. We can have a brief at ease. You want to do a test off the record, or it's kind of odd? Come back on the record. So today we're going to start the second half of this legislature, and I'd like to go ahead and introduce a few people. But before I get into that, we've got the COVID protocol, so we'll be wearing our masks for a while, hopefully not too much longer, depending on the COVID issues itself in and around Juneau. and around, and we'll have discussions amongst the committee members, and obviously legislative council has a lot to say about the mask issue, so we'll be wearing masks in the finance room until further notice. So try to remember that and speak into the mics, and we'll go forward. And if the recorder has trouble picking you up, just signal the chairman, whoever's chairing the meeting, and we'll work on getting a good recording for the historical records and the transcribing the meeting. So I'd like to go ahead and introduce a few people. Sitting behind me is Mr. Pete Eklund. He's the operating budget coordinator. Also, Amanda Ryder, the finance aide. She also helps with the operating budget and lots of other things dealing with finance. Both those two individuals work in my office, but they're here to assist other committee members on budgetary issues. Also, the committee aides with budgetary issues. So don't hesitate to ask questions, as you know. And then also here is behind me, it's David Scott. He's behind me. Yep. David Scott, does the committee scheduling. He's finance aide and other duties as assigned by my office. Senator Bishop with his office. And for those watching at home, Senator Bishop concentrates on the capital budget and all legislation in front of the committee. And I do the operating budget and appropriation bills. So we have the workload kind of separated. We have with him Mr. Chris Clark. He's not here today, but he's the capital budget coordinator. He was a coordinator last year also. Ms. Erin Schein, committee scheduling and legislation. She's over here on my right. All legislation in front of the committee goes across her desk. She's the head committee aide for all legislation. So committee aides that have any questions, concerns, scheduling issues, whatever, get hold of Ms. Schein. I'd like to welcome Cody Grusendorf. He's a new finance aide to the committee, sitting behind Senator Bishop. He works in Senator Bishop's office. His duties are whatever his boss assigns him. Then next down the table, Senator Von Imhoff. Behind her is Ms. Rose Foley. She's a finance aide. Ms. Foley's been in and around this committee for many years. I think she started at the secretarial pool here working with the aides, putting the meetings together. Now she's a full-blown financial aide for the committee, and I'd like to just have people take notice of that over the years. That's been a very good experience for her. With Senator Olson is Rix Hahn, committee aide behind her. Hopefully I got your name close, if not correct. And this is your second year? Yep, second year with the committee. Senator Wilikowski, aide is Sonia Kawasaki, and she is not here. I don't see her, but she's been here as his aide for several years. Senator Wilson, we'll have Mr. Gary Zepp. This is financial aide. Gary Zepp has many years of budgetary experience also, not only at this committee, but other locations within the legislative arena. So he's got a lot of good history behind him. And then with Senator Hoffman, who's not here, behind Senator Hoffman's chair is Mr. Tim Grusendorf, financial aide to Mr. Hoffman, or Senator Hoffman. And Mr. Grusendorf's been an aide to the committee for many, many years. There's a rumor that Cody Grusendorf is related to him, and I can assure you that Cody is his son. So we'll put that rumor to rest. If they aren't exactly related. Now, that doesn't mean there's going to be good family communication on what we work on the table between the two, or they're going to agree. But anyway, and I'd like to just note as a side note, Tim Grusendorf's dad, along with Cody's granddad, was my teacher in high school for government. And I also used to lifeguard Tim in high school to make sure he was would be available for, I didn't know it, as a committee aide, as he got older and didn't drown in the pool. So, then if we go to the committee secretaries, Donnie Agat, she's back there. She's in charge of taking care of the room. And I would like to note she has many years of experience, and the room is always ready for the committee. And it's because of the hard work of her and her employees that I'm going to list here in a minute that actually happens. So I really appreciate the efficiency of her team. Allison Huntkamp, where's Allison at? Not here today. Marta Lestefka, I got it right. That's good. I'd just like the record to note this is the first time, and I've introduced her for, I don't know, maybe 10 times. There's always hope that we'd get it right. So, and then Laura Hosley. Yep, and she's behind the screen and taking copious notes. We will introduce the Legislative Finance Division as they come before us. There's a whole list of them, but I'll wait till they're actually here. And then the Legislative Information Office staff, Doug Bridges and Jake Wade, they're here. They're trying to keep the information flow going. So we will go through the process very similar to last year, where we will take the submitted budgets from the executive branch, and we will pull out all of the non-recurring funds and fund adjustments and boil it down like we did the last couple of years to the base budget, and we'll have that as committee substitute zero. So we will have an actual accurate document where we are financially. That'll take a few weeks. We did that the last few years, and it was very helpful for the committee and the people in the building and the public. And then we'll layer on after that dealing with other fund sources, federal, COVID, as we build the budget together to take it forward. I think it's very important that we have a base document to go to, because we could, for instance, claim a budget is balanced when it's not with reoccurring revenue, and we want to concentrate on reoccurring revenue. So if we isolate and identify a structural deficit issue, the committee then could go forward and work on trying to solve that, and also recognize it when we are looking at fiscal notes or additive costs for legislation that will be before the committee, because there's a limited amount of funds. We're going to have at the table the same, I guess, the same structures we've had before. Just as a reminder, if you're hungry, you can always get up and leave at any time, go to, you know, go have a bite to eat, but please don't eat at the table. We won't be having iPads and newspapers and magazines and those type of stuff at the table. The public that comes here and the presenters come here, and they appreciate our undivided attention to their presentations. Some folks, particularly the public members, have never been here before, and it's a very big issue for them, and also kind of scary, and we want to make sure that they're comfortable and we're paying attention. And also cell phones, please mute your cell phones. They're distracting. So the protocol will be the same as we've had in the past. And if there's any concerns or issues from committee members, just let the Senator Bishop or myself know, because we work as a team here at the table. And I would like to make one more comment before we go into the Department of Natural Resources oil production forecast today. Just for the public, this is the most experienced finance staff ever assembled in the legislature that I'm aware of in years of experience and backgrounds. And we don't agree on everything around the table, and I don't want the committee to be a rubber stamp committee. So we'll be having some thorough discussions and analysis on whatever subjects are in front of us, and we'll work together collaboratively to come up with solutions and budgets like we've done in the past. But this is not a beginning finance committee in any way, shape, or form. We do have two new committee aides, and we'll be working with them and bringing them up to full speed. And that'll be starting Friday. They're going to have their own meetings on that subject of bringing all of the aides together. So I just wanted to mention that, because we'll have to be cognizant of and recognize that we can drop into the depths of a subject pretty fast and very deep. And we need to try to remember that we got to have these meetings are for the public, and we need to make sure that the acronyms are used lightly, and we present the information, no matter how complicated, in a format that is easily understood by Alaskans sitting around their kitchen table wondering, what is the Senate Finance Committee doing, and how come I can't understand it? And so we want to make sure the public understands what we're doing and why we're doing what we're recommending. So with all that being said, Senator Bishop, do you have any opening comments before we go into our first presentation?
I just have one. Thanks for the opening comments, Chair Stedman. But I just want to boil back down to a safety minute for a moment for everyone in the room. We do have these tables that have been wonderfully refinished. We're working on getting some softeners for the corners of these tables. Please be careful. Don't bump into any of these staff tables. The second thing I'd like to say is we have several ways out of this building in an emergency. One is right through that door, out that staircase, and down the stairwell. Those doors are not locked. We have a stairwell and an elevator out the door. You know where those are, but I just want to reaffirm we can exit the building right here. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And hopefully the chairmans aren't so scary that the presenters run out the door in the middle of their presentation. Okay, with that, I would like to thank the Department of Natural Resources for coming forward today, the Deputy Commissioner John Crowther and Pascal Imiqui, is that close enough?
Close enough.
Yeah, I'll have you restate your name for the record so we get that. Commercial Analyst, Division of Oil and Gas. And I'd like to welcome you. What we'll do is we'll walk through, as a standard procedure, we'll walk through your presentation a slide at a time. I'll watch the table. And if a committee member signals me that they have a question on a slide, I'll wait till your slide is complete and your statements are done, and then we'll pick up the questions, and then we'll go on. I'll watch the clock. We have till 11 o'clock. I'll watch the clock for you and time it on your slide so we'll be done in time. With that, I'd like you guys to go ahead and introduce yourself for the records and take us through your presentation, please.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Crowther. I'm the incoming Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, for the record. And just a note, I believe our Commissioner Corey Feige is also online, and we might like to make a brief introductory statement once we introduce ourselves.
For the record, I'm Maduabuchi Pascal Umekwe. I currently work as a reservoir engineer for the Division of Oil and Gas. I used to be a commercial analyst, just like you introduced earlier. And Yeah, so maybe we'll take some comments from the commissioner before we continue.
Go ahead and pull your mics up a little bit. Go ahead and continue. And
Commissioner Feige, you want to say something?
Pardon me?
Commissioner Feige, you want to say something?
I don't. Commissioner Feige, are you online?
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, good morning.
Very good. For the record, my name is Corey Feige. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and DNR is very pleased to be here with you all this morning presenting the fall 2021 production forecast. My apologies for not yet being able to be in Juneau. I will be there with you as of this Sunday. So to begin, you've met the folks in the room who will be there to present the forecast and answer any questions that you've got, our Deputy Commissioner John Crowther and Dr. Umekwe. In 2021, the oil sector saw recovery from the chaos and extreme price and demand fluctuations that were so prevalent during 2020 and the peak of the global pandemic. The International Energy Agency notes that demand has now been ahead of supply since the third quarter of 2020 through the fourth quarter of 2021. And 2022 seems to be lending itself to higher and more stable prices that we now see. You may know that Alaska North Slope crude closed at just above $89 a barrel yesterday. 2022 will likely see global rebalancing and continued strong prices, though that can change quickly in this very uncertain and highly politically charged global environment. At their most recent meeting on January 4th, OPEC Plus nations announced that they plan to continue their restrained monthly increase in supply. Some analysts worry that this is restrained, as that this restrained approach indicates that that idle capacity in some of these nations will be difficult to return to production. And it's this market sentiment that's driven prices higher over the past couple of weeks. Stronger, more stable prices and increased demand is good for Alaska's industry. Though in the current political climate, companies across the petroleum sector, and especially those operating in Alaska, face significant headwinds. There's pressure on all companies to exhibit capital discipline and increase shareholder profits and returns. That, combined with climate activism, is resulting in financial barriers and slower reinvestment in the sector. Though the times are uncertain, Alaska's operators are taking full advantage of the price rise and near-term stability to continue to capture more efficiency and production from our existing assets. This is resulting in somewhat flattened decline rates across several of Alaska's major North Slope fields. And so with that backdrop and setup, I'll hand it off to Dr. Umekwe for the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any immediate questions for the commissioner while she's hot on the line? Okay, go ahead and continue your presentation.
Thank you, Chair. So today we'll be talking about the oil production outlook for the state for the next decade. And as you all are aware, the Department of Natural Resources has been conducting this forecast since 2016. So our hope today is in a matter of a couple of slides, you know, just talk you through a background on what happened last year, the last fiscal year, FY 2021. Then discuss a little bit on the approach that we take in generating the numbers that we provide to the Department of Revenue, that kind of guides the revenue projections and some of the decisions you've been making, as well as provide the results, you know, that we came up with. So at any point, please feel free to stop me and, you know, if you have any questions. But our presentation is broken into three different segments, and the first segment is going to be more of a background on FY 2021. The next segment will talk about the approach that we take in generating our numbers. And the last segment would provide the results that we came up with. And as I transition between segments, I'll also pause to take any questions. So on slide four, just talking about FY 2021. So here we see a slide that shows what the department had forecasted about 12 months ago, you know, for FY 2021, and how that forecast performed in comparison to the actual production. So in the black bar you see there on the chart to the right, the black bar you see there on the chart to the right is actual production, and thank you so much. And all the gray bars you see are the forecast that we had, you know, about 12 months ago for what production would be like. So the first thing I would like us to take from this is actual production came within our range, which is what we our method, you know, essentially promises implicitly. That compared to our expected case, which is this middle case, you know, production was about 5% higher than what we had projected, you know, in this specific case. And right here we see an aggregated look of what the operators thought production would be like. So overall, two key points to take from this is our forecast continues to provide a good guidance for revenue planning and some of the decisions you make. Most often on a case-by-case basis, you would see the actual numbers will always be different. So that is expected. But the goal is to ensure that the actual numbers don't fall very much far away from what we project. So here we also point out two of the factors that are shaping, you know, a lot of the work we do in generating the forecast for the state. I think the commissioner alluded to this earlier. We see a strong environment for environmental, social, and governance issues. So here we have companies who are beginning or in some ways continuing to allocate capital in a manner that reflects some of the changing wishes of their shareholders and their investors. So as a result of that, different companies approach this differently. We hear of the energy transition and some of the factors that are, you know, driving that. Companies have a menu of options to pick from. So those options range from, you know, carbon capture and, you know, underground storage to, you know, electric vehicles or whatever. And our lessees are also part of this transition. They are also taking decisions that reflect a realization that that is a direction that the industry is going. Another factor that is that has affected the way we provide our forecast in the last 12 to 24 months is the COVID pandemic. And we all can see ourselves with masks here. It didn't used to be this way. So many companies reacted to that in different ways. We had curtailments of production. We had stop of activities, and but in the last 12 months, we've seen those activities begin to, you know, come back up. So that reflects, you know, the decisions that companies make. In some cases, very different from what decisions or factors they used to consider in the past. So that kind of paints a landscape for what we where we are now. So we've seen 24 months where prices have, you know, ranged from, you know, negative numbers to, you know, where they are now, close to $90 per barrel, like the commissioner mentioned. So moving on to slide five.
We're going to stop there on slide four. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So I do appreciate slide four when you have the high of 525, mid 469, and low 413. Do you have a calculation or a slide that just shows how that translates to revenue to the state at various prices that you guys have estimated? You know, you're showing from 2020, fiscal year 21, 22, where we're in now, and then 23, 24, maybe 4 years. And if it's at 60 versus 65, you know, versus the whole low, medium, high. So we can see the variation at this table. Are we talking 400 million variation? Are we talking 250 million? Because that's material. And so I think, I don't know, Chair Stedman, if that would be helpful.
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, we'd be happy to work with our sister agency, the Department of Revenue, and prepare a summary slide to that effect.
Right. I think what we'll do here is we'll have that request moved on to the Department of Revenue, because they're going to follow you guys in the day. So we'll have that tied into Department of Revenue's forecast. And for those watching at home, all oil is not the same as far as dollars to the state treasury. All oil is beneficial to the volume and taps, our Trans-Alaska pipeline, and helps with tariffs. But there's significant differences depending on where this oil comes from. So we'll have Department of Revenue explain that to the committee members. And any support you guys could give them would be beneficial. Okay, go ahead. Any other questions on slide four? Okay, next slide, please.
Thank you very much, Senator Stedman. And Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, just one thing I wanted to add to that is the revenue sources book. I think there is a page somewhere in the appendix that lists exactly what, you know, the senator is requiring to know. it does some kind of a sensitivity around prices. But that is something that, like you mentioned earlier, the DOR will be glad to handle. So moving on to slide five. So here we show kind of a snapshot of activities or production for the North Slope. And like we mentioned in the very first bullet point there, you know, all fields are generally expected to see a year-on-year decline. So all else being equal, you would see production in the fields, you know, decline. And that's in the absence of active drilling or some active work, you know, at some point in time. So, but what we've seen on the North Slope in the last year is a significant progress, you know, in the way the companies manage the fields. For example, at least for the last year, we have a 2%, you know, growth in production. So to grow production, that would mean you're stemming decline as well as adding volumes. So that is a significant achievement that we kind of have to report on. So the slide below, that's the bottom right, shows us the different fields and how they performed, you know, contributing to the volumes that we see for FY 2021. So as you can see there, the increases are in green and the decreases are in red. So tying back to the first statement I made, we're expecting to see red all across. You know, that's the natural behavior of mature fields like what we have. So, but when you see a green, you know, bar there, that tells you, you know, there's some activity, there's some action taken by operators to really make that happen. So some of the fields that we wanted to bring your attention to are fields like the Greater Prudhoe Bay Unit, where we see a 5% production growth, you know, due to you know, significant well and facility optimization efforts by the operator out there. And also moving on to the Muni Point unit, many of you are aware of the Moose's pad and some of the activities that have been going on there. So as a result of that consistent drilling, we saw about a 20% production growth. So that too is a significant feat. Then in the Point Thompson unit, the third one there, over the years, first of all, in the last year, we saw a transition from ExxonMobil to Hilcorp as operator for that asset. But in the last 6 years that ExxonMobil managed that field, they worked through a lot of the surface facility challenges at that unit as a result of the high pressures that they faced there kind of pose. They had to create, you know, first-in-class equipments to be able to, and compressors to be able to inject gas at the pressures that that field requires. So walking through those issues, in the last, if you look at our slides, in the last 2 or 3 years, you see a consistent, you know, story around a Point Thompson unit, which is a testament to the work that they have done to bring it up to where it is now. So at current, I think you have production somewhere between, you know, 8,500 to 9,500 or 10,000. Across the last couple months. And in addition to that, you have the field operating at the wells, you know, upline or always online, you know, for the entire period of the year, whereas in 2016 that was not the case. So moving down to some of the fields that...
Well, I want you to finish your slide, please. I'll run the meeting. You just concentrate on your presentation and okay. Then stop at the end of every slide for just a second.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead.
So some of the other fields that we saw some level of decrease, I think the Kuparuk River unit essentially held flat, you know, so because that decrease is really small for given the size of the asset. We see just about 300 barrels. And the Greater Moses Tooth 1, we see a significant drop in that unit as a result of other challenges that the operator is essentially walking through. But again, right down couple slides, we'll see some good stories about the GMT unit as well. And in Uguruk, we point out, you know, the absence of drilling, and as a result of that, we see some decline in that. I'll stop now for any questions.
Okay, Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On Point Thompson, we had a settlement agreement with the operator several years ago. My recollection is that they were to produce 10,000 barrels a day of condensate. Correct me if I'm wrong, but can you just talk about where we are in terms of the Point Thompson development? Is the plan to go forward as a gas field, as an oil field? Are they following the terms of the settlement agreement? Has there been any attempts to get out of the settlement agreement or change it in any way?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. So that is a question that I think we can better fully answer, you know, out of here. We'll kind of prepare a response for you. But just a quick summary on it is the goal of that agreement, as you recall, was to produce, I think, 200 million scf of gas, you know, per day. As a result of that, gas comes with some rich ends or rich, you know, oil with it, condensate with it. So we've had about 9 or 10 months of production somewhere around, you know, 9,500 and above. So in many ways, the operator has kept, you know, production really high. But more importantly is the challenges that they have been able to, you know, walk through, you know, throughout this period. And just also for the record, there is a report that the operator promised to send out to AOGCC that will detail some of the learnings that they've had, you know, over these years for that asset. And I think that's going to be something that other agencies or the AOGCC could speak to. But if you want like more on this, this is something we could prepare for you.
If you can get back to the committee, and also on that point, Thompson, I'd like to also, when you get back with your response, put in there the tariff structure of Point Thompson, because the tariff, getting the condensate out of Point Thompson into TAPS is something that the committee's kept an eye on over the years.
Absolutely, sir.
And do you have a follow-up question, Senator?
I do, not on Point Thompson, but on, I think maybe closer to Prudhoe Bay Park, but I had a briefing with the governor's office, the governor's team, a few weeks ago on the budget, and they had mentioned that there, I can't recall, if, I thought it was gas that was previously being shipped and re-injected may not be doing that anymore, and that there was oil that was now being counted towards production that hadn't previously been counted towards production. Does that sound familiar to you at all? And maybe can you explain that?
So, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, is that about the NGLs that were being moved from Prudhoe Bay to Kuparo Kurene? Okay, yeah. So, over the last couple years, natural gas liquids were being shipped from Prudhoe Bay unit to the Kuparo River unit for use in enhanced oil recovery in that asset. And that operation stopped. So that pipeline is now transferring gas instead for use as fuel, you know, for operations in the Kuparo River unit. So talking about how that affects the numbers that we provided to DOR or how DOR does its work, DOR could go more into that, but the short story on that is the production from the natural gas that leaves, the natural gas liquids that leave Prudhoe Bay unit, we pay royalty on that because it crosses the unit boundaries. And when it goes over to Kuparo River unit, it pays its own royalty upon production. So they use it, you know, re-inject it into the reservoir and produce more oil. And as a result of that, the cost of doing that operation is kind of adjusted within the numbers or the total revenues that the operator has to pay at the Kuparo River unit. So that is something that we could, you know, describe a little bit better or have a DOR, you know, speak to it. So in the last revenue sources book, there was always a 10,000 barrels of oil per day adjustment of Prudhoe's production to reflect that those volumes don't go directly to TAPS, but they go to the Kuparo River unit. But now that assumption is taken off. And if you look at DOR's revenue sources book, you see a note there that states that is no longer the assumption that we're going by. So we're assuming that gas will be going through that line for the outlook period.
Is that reflected at all in this forecast? Does that change any of the numbers here? Does that increase or decrease any of the numbers at Prudhoe or Kaparik or anywhere?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, no. So the numbers you see here are the numbers as produced from the ground. So the numbers that go, you know, into TAPS, essentially.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Are there questions from committee members? So could you talk a little bit about the processing facilities, how many processing facilities we have up there, and which ones are at full capacity, which ones may not be, And in particular, when we look at Prudhoe Bay and Melanie Point, there's increases. Are those through efficiencies in processing facilities? And if so or not, what percentage gain would do you think that would be applicable to the processing facilities?
So just to speak on the full count of our processing facilities is something we could take a while to kind of talk through. But the Prudhoe Bay unit has about 6 processing facilities, and the Kuparuk River unit about 3 processing facilities. And I think a portion of your question was, you know, which amount of those facilities are, you know, operational or so. All those facilities are operational. So, but the gains that we saw in the Greater Prudhoe Bay unit is as a result of the utilization of the capacity of that facility. For example, if you don't have enough room in a capacity in a facility, you may not be able to process as much gas or as much water that comes with the oil. So one of the ways that Hilcorp has used to kind of improve production within the Greater Prudhoe Bay unit is to ensure that those facilities are working at the most, you know, capacity that they show. So right now, if you look at the data, you see that the level of gas handling or water handling within those facilities goes as far back as record levels that you had maybe in 2005 or so. So that is one of the, in some ways, the miracles of what Hilcorp has been able to achieve. Because by running the facilities at that level, you're able to maybe bring on some wells that in the past were very mature that you wouldn't want to bring in because of the difficulties that poses in terms of the amount of gas or water that you would have to handle.
Okay, so when you get back to the committee, could you get back to the committee with a little more explanation on the processing facilities? There's 9 of them, as I recall, or whatever. I think Alpine had significant capacity last time we checked. Due to, I guess, they were more optimistic on when they built it than, you know, what kind of production they can get out of the ground. And then I'd also like you to try to enlighten the committee a little bit, because we've got a new operator in Prudhoe Bay that's done a lot of work. And I'd like to get a feel for, with the change of operators, the amount of benefit that they've brought to the table by enhancing the processing facilities at Prudhoe to increase production versus, you know, drilling new wells or what have you. Okay. Yeah, because it's an area that we don't touch on much. We always kind of skip over the processing facilities, but they're a substantial bottleneck and have been for years. In production. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. On the chairman's point, production facilities. I've heard Oil Search has reached out and tried to use Conoco's production facility or their treatment plant for their project. Are you aware of that? Is that something that Conoco has agreed to allow, or is that something Conoco is opposing?
So, Senator, through the chair, yes, we are aware of those negotiations and discussions between the company, both as they relate to seawater treatment and oil and liquids processing. So we are aware of those discussions. The PICA project, as designed by Oil Search, does include a significant processing facility and the potential to step that out in future years, which would, to the chair's point, add significantly to the capacity of the Western North Slope. So a very significant benefit to the state.
Follow up, but we want to.
Well, and, you know, I understand the company negotiations that occur. And at the same time, like you said, we do have a significant interest in this. And to what degree is the administration participating in that negotiation? Is there something that we as a legislature need to do to maybe encourage the parties to agree to that negotiation? Because we stand to benefit tremendously if that access is allowed. As the owner of the oil, we have a direct and very strong interest in seeing that facility is allowed to be used at a reasonable rate. Is that a fair statement? And what are we doing to make sure that happens?
Yes, that's a very fair point, Senator. And through the chair, I think our commissioner might like to speak to this as well.
Right, and this, again, we get into this commercial relationship, and a new entrance could build their own facility. They have to negotiate access into other facilities. So, you know, we have a separation here. Commissioner Faggy, are you still online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am. Thank you. And back on the record, this is Corey Feige, Commissioner of DNR. Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, to your point, and just to clarify for the public and members of the committee, Oil Search has opted for the PICA development to construct their own seawater treatment facility. There were issues in terms of the chemistry of the water that could be used for maximizing oil production out of PICA if they were to source that water through Conoco's existing seawater treatment facility. So we will have facilities side by side. It's also my understanding that for accommodating Willow production, that Conoco will need to expand their Lictock Point seawater treatment facility as well. PICA has always, Oil Search, has always intended to construct their own oil processing facilities. Those will be modularized in two phases, and the plan as it stands now is to begin with 80,000 barrels a day, stepping up to between 120 or up to a maximum of 160,000 barrels per day in phase two with a second module. Where we have overlapping need and use is in the access roads, the spine road that crosses the Colville River unit. And the two parties are now in the process of negotiating, as Mr. Chairman referenced, the commercial arrangement for long-term access. What's important for the committee to know and for the public to know is that both in the case of the Colville River unit and the PICA unit, these are state resources being developed on state leases on state lands. And the administration is prepared. We have the authority. Should the parties not be able to arrive at a commercial arrangement, we do have the authority and a structure through which to engage the state, because we share your concern that this is incredibly important to the state of Alaska. And so we're monitoring this very closely and engaging with both parties, encouraging them to reach that commercial arrangement. That is the fastest path for both companies. But we do have a process by which we would engage if they're not successful.
Commissioner, can you talk a little bit on the time value? Because, you know, time value of money is important in these developments. And do you watch that? And then would you step in if one entity is like burning the clock on the other one or what have you for some financial advantage? Or how do you deal with that issue? And then we're going to go to Senator Von Imhoff, and I think Senator Wilikowski. You have another follow-up, Senator Wilikowski? Yeah, we'll go to Von Imhoff, then back to Wilikowski.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, yes, thank you for that question. That's an excellent question, because you are correct. Time value of money is very important, and we are watching very closely the proposed timelines that Oil Search and now with their merged partner Santos have for making a final investment decision on the project. We are told that full financial investment decision, or FID, for the project is due to come in Q2 of 2022. So we're just a couple of short months away. We're monitoring this very closely and are actively engaged as we speak right now with the entities in the matter of the access agreement.
Okay. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I think that is an issue that's definitely becoming more to light, I think, recently, as in it's not just using each other's facilities, but it's just simple access to landlocked leases. So what's the incentive for available state land to be put on lease? And if a company looks at it and says, well, I can't access it unless I build an ice road through someone else's leased property or leased parcel, and it's going to cost me a lot of money to do that. So what is the state doing to help reassure and, in fact, guarantee that lessors can access their parcels in a timely manner and in a cost-effective manner. Because I think that's a problem now, where people are not being able to, or companies are not being able to access their parcels.
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, in response to your question, you know, first of all, what is nuanced about this particular development is this is the first time that we've had a party developing a new field that is not a working interest owner in the unit or the leases that they need to cross to get there. So this is the first of its kind. In the past, historically, what's happened is we have had working interest owners or companies that own interests in both fields, and so they've been able to work out commercial arrangements. And even in the instance where we've had companies that need to utilize facilities or cross, they've always been able to arrive at a commercial arrangement. Again, this is the first one where those companies have been unable to get there. And so that has resulted in the administration going back and taking a very, very close look at the lease language. It's important for everyone to know that there is no exclusivity in access across state leases. The language in the leases and in the unit agreements clearly spells out that other operators, other third parties will be able to cross because there is no exclusive use that is granted to the lessor for the state surface. So lots of layers to the onion, and we peel that apart by looking at the lease language, by looking at the unit agreements and the unit agreement language. And then through statutes and regulation have a path for the state to engage now when commercial negotiations fail.
Okay, Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. And I understand the state should typically take a light hand in getting involved in negotiations between private companies. But at the same time, if we truly want to encourage new players, new companies to come into the state, it is extremely expensive to build these plants. We have a plant there. It is something that is usable, and so I do hope the state would get involved in this and encourage some sort of settlement, because we stand to benefit more, quite frankly, from Oil Search's development at Pica, because that's on state land, than we do from Conoco's development of Willow, which is on federal land. And as the owner of the resource, I would encourage you, and I'm glad to hear that the state is taking an active interest in that. Thank you.
I think if I could, Madam Commissioner, maybe you can keep the committee posted on the progress of this issue as it rolls forward the next couple months. Senator Wilikowski.
And I guess while we got the commissioner on the line, if I could, Mr. Chair, just going back to Point Thompson, because my understanding is that roughly 2 years ago, we arrived at a point where one of three things needed to happen at Point Thompson. Number one, the companies were to produce more than 10,000 barrels per day of condensate oil. Number two, there was going to be a major gas sale at Prudhoe. Number three, there was going to be a blowdown of gas at Prudhoe. None of those things have happened. And I'm just curious why a new settlement agreement was signed.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I think what you are referencing is the letter agreement that was signed under the previous administration by my predecessor, Commissioner Mack, and the owners and operators of Point Thompson unit. What that letter agreement did was extend the trigger date within the original Point Thompson settlement agreement. And in doing so at the time, and this was purely speculation upon my part, I wasn't in the room, but at the time, I believe that the intent was to give more time for negotiation for a major gas sale, which was being discussed at the time with the previous administration. But we'll be very happy to give you a thorough update on where we're at with the Point Thompson settlement agreement. by ExxonMobil working out the technical difficulties. The public and members of the committee will remember that that Point Thompson is a very technically difficult field. It's extremely high pressure. It's one of the highest pressure operating assets in the world, with an average reservoir pressure of just about 10,000 PSI. And so the prior operator, Exxon, made a great deal of investment in some new technology for compressor heads that would be able to handle that over the long haul. And it's that investment that led to the stability in the past year now of being able to maximize that liquids production. And they have to re-inject the gas, and you have to get above reservoir pressure in order to do that. And that was the difficulty, and where, frankly, just the mechanics continued to break. So we're over that technical hurdle, and now with stabilized production and now a new operator in to really capture efficiencies in that production process, I think there's a lot of upside there. And we still continue to have projects out there exploring wellhead pricing for gas offtake for a major gas sale, and the concept of a blowdown at Prudhoe Bay, I know is even still under technical consideration. So we'll be very happy to present the committee with an update on all of the above and include a tracking of the tariff as Mr. Chairman requested.
Right, thank you. Madam Commissioner, I was going to ask to roll this into the other responses of Point Thompson, and we may need, with the complexity of Point Thompson, you know, the department to come and do a presentation to us, because it is a significant asset. And the state has, I don't know, $3-4 billion in credits that we've paid into Point Thompson. So we have a significant percentage of the funds that have been invested in Point Thompson through the credit mechanism that was used at the time. And anyway, if we could do that, and then we'll work with the department on when the committee on when to have Point Thompson update, and that could be kind of a filler here between our budget stuff. I think Senator Wilikowski and Senator Von Imhoff brought up some good points, so we should come up to speed on Point Thompson. We haven't done that in a while, and it'll also give the opportunity then to talk about the benefits of blowing the gas down in Prudhoe to extend the life of Prudhoe Bay if we don't take the gas off, and the complexities of that and where that situation is. Great. Any other questions on this slide before we speed on to number six? Slide number six, please.
So slide number six here, we shift focus a little bit and talk about the Cook Inlet basin and the performance of that basin in the last couple fiscal years. So this top chart on the right shows that performance. And again, we continue to state like the importance of the basin, you know, in feeding the refineries within the state and also providing revenues through royalty in kind sales. So looking at the last fiscal year, we see a 3,000 barrels of oil per day loss, you know, or decline in that basin. Again, because of the small volumes we're talking about for the Cook Inlet, you know, that amounts to somewhere around 20%, you know, decline. But again, going back to what we mentioned earlier about the COVID pandemic and some of the fallouts, you know, oil price collapse and things related to that, a lot of the reasons behind the 22% drop you see there are tied to COVID. Two of the fields that we highlight, you know, were shut in, you know, for a protracted period of time, but those fields are back online since September, October of 2021.
Are you finished with that slide?
So that's the highlight for that.
Okay. As I recall, I think the tax structure terminates and Cook Inlet maybe in 22 or sometime, so we need to get spun up on that if that's an issue coming at us, where that is. Senator Von Imhoff.
So, yes, this is an interest in that. What is 2022? COVID is a big part of 2021, but is this production going to go back up for 2022? Is demand, what has demand been doing that whole time? Or what does it look like in the future? What about supply reserves? I know that there was a big reserve NSTAR, I think, has reserves in the Kiski, I'm not quite sure, but how is production going to look like in the future? Do we need to create more demand, as in people have been talking about an in-state bullet line from McKinsey Point to Fairbanks? How is the Fairbanks market affecting this? Are they trucking it right now, or is there a train? What can we do to boost production and demand in Cook Inlet so we don't ever have to import gas in Alaska? We don't want to do that.
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, I'll let Pascal speak to this in a little bit more detail. This slide is focused on the oil production from the basin, okay, obviously associated with the natural gas investments, and which are, as you note, so critical to energy supply for our state, for our rail belt communities. Pascal, do you have any additional detail on some gas?
So just a little bit to add to that, Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair. Again, currently, the department has a couple different initiatives or studies going on to continue to understand the basin. I think the last publication that we put out was in 2018. You know, that's on our website, that discusses, you know, an outlook for the basin. But currently, we're working on a product that continues to look at gas, you know, for the basin. But much of the presentation we have here, you know, like the commissioner mentioned, is focused on oil.
I apologize. You're right. It is oil. My mind went to gas because that's what I think in Cook Inlet. We can put that on the back burner and perhaps talk about it later.
And we can have Department of Revenue touch on the tax structure of Cook Inlet, because I think we are getting to the to a change point here. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And as someone who represents Anchorage in South Central, I share the concerns about the declining production. But if you know, or maybe somebody can go back and get to us, but my understanding is we currently have 0% production taxes in Cook Inlet, 0% royalties in Cook Inlet, and we still have the highest natural gas prices, my understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, the highest natural gas prices in North America in Anchorage, Alaska. Is that correct? Those three things, do you know? Or if not, maybe somebody can get back to us.
Yes, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. I know the Revenue Sources book, you know, lays out the tax structure for both the North Slope and the Cook Inlet Basin. And and also the DOR puts out the prevailing prices. So that's public information that anyone can take a look at. Mm-hmm.
I think we can wrap some of these questions to the Department of Revenue, and I think one of the points maybe that Senator Wilikowski was making is it's not a high tax structure that's affecting this. We have no oil tax for any meaningful definition in Cook Inlet as a direct policy to try to stimulate production in Cook Inlet. Direct policy call several years ago. That's also, Senator Wilikowski, something we could do later on also is have an update just on Cook Inlet, both oil and gas, depending on, take a look at Senator Von Imhoff before we go to the next slide.
Very, very quick. Is that I see, you know, we're going from 16,000 barrels to 10,000 barrels. If oil production, for whatever reason, stops in Cook Inlet, will that affect the gas production, or are they independent?
So, Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, I could comment on that. So, there is gas in the inlet that has no, that's unassociated, right? So, just gas that is being produced from gas wells. And there is gas produced from, you know, oil wells, so the associated gas. So, some of the associated gas will be affected by that, you know. But much of the gas in the inlet is like from, you know, unassociated, you know, gas wells drilled for the purpose of gas production.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Next slide, please.
So moving on to slide 7, here we just have a snapshot. We try to carry this slide through most of our presentations. So we have a snapshot of some of the projects on the horizon that could be changing the production that we see, especially on the North Slope, you know, in the next two or so fiscal years. So on the first three lines there show us a lot of activity within the Colville River Unit. So we have the Fjord West Kuparuk PA, you know, within that unit. For that development, the operator had to construct, you know, an extended reach drilling rig, which is currently drilling some wells, you know, to bring the Fjord West project, you know, to bring it online. And based on the numbers that we've seen in the public, we have peak rates reaching somewhere around 20,000 barrels of oil per day. So that is a significant, that will be a significant contribution to ongoing production. Again, we try to mention this from time to time. Of course, when we see the peak production, often the field doesn't come online at that rate. You know, it comes online at a much smaller rate, then builds up to that rate, after which you see a decline. So when we state the peak, you know, that's just to help guide how we receive that number. Then also we have a CD5 second expansion also currently being drilled. The Nawal PA development within the Corvey River unit, we have good news on that. We had first oil, or first sustained oil production in December from one of the four wells or so that have been drilled up to this time. But the plan is to ramp that up to about 12 wells, then later on, you know, down in the decade, to add a pad and drill 20 to 40 wells. Then GMT-2, we have another good story for that. We saw first oil for that in November or so of 2021. And the expected peak rate for that rises somewhere to about 30,000 barrels of oil per day. Then the other two projects below, we touched on them already in previous questions. So we have the Pika development by Oil Search / Santos. And we now know that the merger is completed, and the commissioner talked a lot about this project already. So we could be seeing peak rate from phase one, you know, up to about 80,000 barrels of oil per day. And the way the development is designed is kind of modular, in the sense that you could have like a 40,000 barrels of oil per day added to that, or 40 more, you know, added to that. Then the last that we mentioned there is the Willow development. Just as an update to that, it's also something that's public information for everyone. We had a court decision that has taken the operator back, you know, to the drawing board to look at what issues that they need to resolve to be able to get maybe a second record of decision for that development. So the expectation is that that could construction could start sometime in the first quarter of 2023, and production to come later on past 2025-2026. And the peak rate expected for that development is also very significant, at about 130,000 barrels of oil per day. So looking at all these rates, in addition to the fact that production would start somewhere lower than what you see on the board there, this production is adding on to a declining base production. So while today's production is somewhere around 500,000 barrels of oil per day, it wouldn't be accurate to add those numbers to this to, you know, see what we'll have, because this production will be coming at that time, and at that time you would have had some decline of existing production.
Replacement.
Okay. Next slide.
So we'll switch segments a little bit now, moving from talking about, you know, what has happened in the last year and some of the bright spots that we see in the coming years. And we'll talk more about, you know, the approach that the Department of Natural Resources uses to generate the numbers that you see. So we have several different data sources that the department uses in generating the oil production forecast. And the main data source is a public information that's put out by the AOGCC. So we look at all the pools that are currently producing at a given date. So for example, for the fall 2021 forecast, we had June of 2021 as our data cutoff. So we looked at all the pools that were online at that time. And the engineers within the section who generate a decline curve analysis-based forecasts for these pools. Then we also engage very closely with the Department of Revenue to speak directly with the operators, send questions, have those questions answered, and to give us like an up-to-date view on what the operators are thinking about the different assets. So in addition to that information or the forecast generated from that public information, we also have a couple different projects across the state. You know, this cycle, we had about 20 projects across, you know, at different levels or different stages of development across the state. And we discuss with the operators for these different projects and see where they are and some of the issues around the projects. So we pull that information in and we generate some kind of an independent view on the projects. And we include some kind of uncertainty analysis, trying to see the risks that could drive the contribution, the start time, or other issues related to the project. One thing to note is the method that we use, that we have just described, you know, it has not changed from what we did last year. So this is just the same. We've been consistent, you know, for the last couple years, you know, just keeping the method the same so that the numbers that we see are kind of comparable in some sense. So moving on to slide 10. So here we just described the three different segments of production that we look at. So we look at production from fields that are currently online. So here we're talking about the Prudhoe, Kuparuk, and many of the other fields that we know are online. We look at the operational strategy that the different operators are implementing in those fields. You know, they are enhanced oil recovery mechanisms, the way they manage the fields, and the way they manage base production. We try to understand that. And what makes this really interesting and fitting, you know, that the department is handling it, is because on a day-to-day basis, most of the decisions made around these fields, you know, we are kind of privy to that information. We work with the operators and talk with them to understand a lot about the fields. So we have that segment of production. Then the second segment of production is just future production. So wells that will be drilled, that have not been drilled yet. And we kind of split that into the UD that you see there, under development and under evaluation. So the under development category comprises wells that are going to be drilled in the next, say, 12 months, so in the next FY 2022, for example. While the under evaluation category are, you know, wells that are associated to projects, or associated with projects that will be drilled further out, so beyond 2022, and throughout the 10-year horizon of our forecast. So those would include the Pika, the Willow, and some of those other projects that are a little bit, you know, further out. Another thing that characterizes that bucket is the level of uncertainty, you know, in timing, the level of uncertainty around performance of the project, the level of uncertainty around the commercial risk or commerciality risk, you know, related to the project.
Done with the slide?
Yes, I'm done with it.
So does the industry report every 6 months or every year on future capital spending to the departments? And how, kind of give us a reminder on how that interaction goes between the department and the industry.
Okay. So the companies report on an annual basis to, and the DOR can speak more about their processes, but as a result of the work we do related to the forecast, the companies provide information to the DOR. They provide, you know, capital spending. They provide, you know, details on the plans, you know, related to the projects.
They're planning on future spending?
Yes, they plan on future
spending. And how far out in the future they normally report? 6 months, a year, 2 years, 10 years?
A year. You know, so we have and I think DOR should better handle this, because we have the spending for the entire forecast period, so the 10-year horizon of their spending. That's the typical range of information that we get, or the window across which we get information.
But isn't it a lot more accurate for the next 6 months, a year, or a year and a half in their spending trends than it is trying to guess what they're going to spend 10 years from now?
Yes, that's the expectation. So in the near term, they have it clearer, and they have passed their budgets, you know, within their companies, and know how, you know, what they'll be spending. So it's much clearer in the near term than further out.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two-part question. Part one is, are there any fields or developments now that are getting royalty relief? And part two is, are there any requests for royalty relief?
And before you answer that, let's just, you know, just as a reminder, royalties are in the preview of the Department of Natural Resources, or the other tax structures are in Department of Revenue. So those just as a reminder for those watching at home, it's easy to overlook that situation. But if you could help us with the royalties, and the question, I guess, was a potential royalty relief, which is in our statutes, where a company could apply for royalty relief if their economics are unfavorable.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. So that is something we could go back and check and get back to you on, you know, to know what companies are currently, you know, getting, or what projects are currently getting royalty relief, or what projects are requesting.
Okay, so if you could do that to the committee, because the response will come back to the committee, and we will disperse them amongst the committee members. And then also, in that, not only, I think the question was what companies are currently getting, are receiving royalty relief, but could you add also, you know, what kind of interest the Department of Natural Resources has in just requesting? Maybe they don't get them, but how much interest there is from time to time on royalty relief?
Absolutely, Chair. We'll respond and revert to the committee.
Yeah, that'd be good. And those for watching at home, royalty relief option has been on the books for many, many, many years. It's not related directly to the tax structure changes and adjustments we've had in the last decade and a half. Just so it's clear to the public. Go ahead and continue on. I think Senator Wilkowski, is that take care of the question?
Yeah, and maybe just a follow-up, and I don't know if this is appropriate for them or for DOR, but I know the governor's requested $199 million in cash credits and for this year. Is there an analysis of the cash credits that have been paid out? It's got to be billions, and I know we still owe probably another 700, or at least it's requested million. I'm just curious what we've gotten for that money that we've paid out. Has there been any sort of analysis? Did it work? Did it increase production? Did we just give the money away? Has there been any sort of analysis on that by you or maybe by DOR?
I think it's probably a question more for Department of Revenue. So if you could answer what you could on that, and then we could relay that question to Department of Revenue so they can give us a historical update on credits, because and potential return on, return of, or what have you, financial impacts of that. If you can help us a little bit.
Yeah. Yes, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, yes, I think that's a more appropriate DOR question. But one thing to touch on that is to the extent that the credits incentivized activity, you know, drilling, exploration work, you know, that affects, you know, what production, you know, could come down the line. But again, a look back on, you know, the spending and what that money was used for and things like that, I think that's something DOR could better handle.
We'll go on to page 11. And then also on that, let's remember to break it down in our regions, north of 68 latitude and Cook Inlet. This is a reminder to the committee and the public. We'll break, you know, because all credits aren't equal also. They're targeted for different areas, different fields, different ownership in different fields, what have you.
Okay. So moving on to slide 11. So here we just, the map shows us the range of projects that we considered in generating the forecast. So just a little bit on the map, we see the yellow color represents federal land. The pink colors represent native owned land. And the blue color is state land. And like the chair mentioned, you know, when we started, you know, oil, in many ways, all oil is not the same, you know, and oil produced from projects in different segments of the state, you know, amounts to different amounts of royalty and different production taxes and all that. So that's something the DOR has in the past presented on, and I think they'll be glad to touch on that. But for royalty purposes, the royalties that we get from different pieces or different portions of that map, you know, are different. But the key thing to take from this is the little dots that we see everywhere on the chart, from the very far northwest to the southeast of the chart. So those are the projects that we included in providing an outlook for the next 10 years. And we kind of have a generalized characteristics for all these projects. These are projects that are not yet online or that were not online at our cutoff date of June of 2021. And generally, these projects have higher risks, you know, or uncertainties, you know, related to their development. Also, there are known, you know, discoveries. So oftentimes you hear about projects or prospects or efforts that are being made, but unless it's a discovery, we don't actually consider it for this analysis, just to ensure that we don't throw in a lot of higher, you know, speculative numbers than we should. So we kind of screen every project out there by these basic characteristics that you see here. And most of these require major investments, sometimes long-term investments, you know, before you can see first oil. So that in itself introduces more risks in the evaluation for the projects.
Question from Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Feige, are you still with us?
Yes, Senator, I am.
Do you have a Liberty update for us? Do you know any, are you current on Liberty, or can you give us any information?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, off the top of my head, Liberty has, I will remind the committee had received, first of all, the Liberty development sits in federal waters, not in state waters. And with that, there was a legal challenge to the Liberty permits. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and it's been probably better than a year now, made a determination that Liberty would basically, I believe, have to go back to almost the starting blocks with the permitting. There were questions about, I believe, a biological opinion associated with their National Environmental Policy Act review at the federal level. And I have not heard of any movement on that project by Hillcorp since that time. And given the current federal administration, I'm sure that that's a consideration for trying to advance that project at this time. I'll need to check with Department of Law, and I'll get back to the committee with the timeline on when Hillcorp would need to file a response with the court if they wanted to challenge the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal decision.
And if you could, can you give us a little history in that summary back? Because Liberty's been going on for quite some time, and it'd be nice just to have a little historical synopsis with this submission, please.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bishop, do you have any other questions? Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Has the Department of DNR seen any increase or decrease or about, say, the same in terms of new projects or ongoing projects?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, just looking at some recent statistics, last year we saw applications for four new units on the North Slope. This year we've seen application for two new units. The leasing on the North Slope remains fairly robust, and quite frankly, I think we'll see an increased focus on leasing of state lands in the central North Slope. It's still prospective acreage. The acreage to the east of the Hall Road has Nanushuk, or what we call Brookian play-type prospectivity, and is as yet untested, but we understand that some lessors are planning to move into exploration phase on that state acreage the coming winter of 22-23. So I anticipate that, again, with the headwinds on federal lands, that we will see increased focus on state lands once again. We saw the same thing under the Obama administration.
Okay. Follow-up? Seeing none, we'll go on to the next slide.
You have
a comment?
Just one supplemental comment while the map's on the screen to the chair, Senator Wilson. You'll see on that map blue outline blocks, both on the left, right, and center. Those are leases that are not yet unitized, so they're not yet part of a developing field. Many of those lease positions are relatively new, reflecting new geologic potential that, that people have identified. So we have seen a lot of interest as evidenced by those expanded lease positions in those areas a little bit south of the historically developed field.
Okay. Okay, next slide, please. Or the slide after the next one.
Okay. Yeah, so we kind of switched segments here a little bit. We are moving now to just showing the results that we came up with for this cycle of the forecast. So the key things to take from this slide, of course, we have numbers there that speak to our expectation for FY 2022. So statewide, we have about 500,000 barrels of oil per day. And for the North Slope, we see essentially flat production. So last FY 2021, we had 493,000 barrels of oil per day. And for FY 2022, we're forecasting somewhere around that same range. Then the high and low sides, we also show them there as 430,000 barrels of oil per day on the low side and the possibility for production to be as high as 555,000 barrels of oil per day. So again, those are analyzed daily numbers. So we just, by using that and multiplying by the number of days in a year, you can come up with the volumes that we think would be getting. Then that's for the short term. Then for the long term, we show one of the exercises that we try to do across the years is to compare our outlook for the long term versus the operator's outlook for the long term. Again, the operator submits some numbers to DOR and we aggregate that to, you know, not divulge taxpayer confidential information, but just to show that in the ballpark, you know, we are thinking about, you know, the same on how the outlook is going to be like. So you see that the operator's outlook falls within the range that we are forecasting for the 10-year period. So that's the first point on that. Then secondly, you see that the operator's outlook is in some ways close to our expected case, which is the black line right in the middle. We do not expect the forecast to align. We don't expect our, you know, mid case or expected case to align with the operator's case because we are trying to do this. We do this in a very different way. But the goal is just to ensure that everything falls within the same ballpark. So one thing to note on this slide is we have we plan to send an update that changes the graphic a little bit. But again, it's not a material change, but we'll send that along with the other things that we promised to provide to the committee.
So this chart can then be reflected into the revenue forecast. These are the same forward projected numbers in the revenue forecast, is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. So the chart that we send would be like exactly what you see on the revenue sources book.
Okay, so let's go to Senator Von Imhoff and Senator Wilkowski.
So thank you. So the blue line, could you just repeat what operator, defining what operator is and how it essentially overlays with the expected case?
Okay. So Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair. So all the operators of currently producing assets, all the major assets we've talked about, provide numbers to DOR, their 10-year projections, you know, to DOR. And at the end of our exercise, one of the things we do is to, you know, plot what we have as well as, you know, what an aggregated view of what the operators are thinking, just to see where we fall or where they fall, you know, within the range that we're looking at. And the two check boxes that we kind of place a check mark on is, okay, in the long term, where all that uncertainty lies, you know, do we see the operator somewhere within the range that we are thinking? And the answer to that is yes, that they, you know, what they're thinking is somewhere within our range. Then also we look at the expected case that we have. You know, how does that compare with what the operator has? Often that is not expected to be the same because we are not just using the numbers that they provide. We are doing a ground up assessment that looks at project by project and the level of risks associated with those projects. So I don't know if you need, I should speak more to that, but that's essentially what we're showing here. In the long term, our views are essentially the same, in the ballpark, you know, with that of the operators as related to these assets.
Can I just summarize what I think I heard?
Yes, if you want to.
So thank you. So based on previous slides, you said you do written analysis, you do oral interviews and so forth with the operators, mm-hmm. and they basically tell you what their capital investments are and what they believe, you know, well by well and area by area might be what it is now versus what it could be in the near future. And then you put that in an analysis and create your high, medium, low, but your expected case is happens to be similar to what the operators are telling you that they think is going to happen in the next few years.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
Okay.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe you have a different understanding of this, but just in reading these forecasts for years, what I've tended to notice is that the operator forecasts tend to be optimistic, and the operator forecasts going out, at least in correct me if I'm wrong, this is what I've noticed in doing this for a while. Operators tend to be optimistic, and then the numbers, the actual production numbers, tend to come in lower. And DNR has traditionally come in lower than operators. And so I'm just curious if I'm reading this correctly. There seems to be a huge divergence starting in 2029, going out to 2031, where now it looks like DNR is projecting, if I'm reading this right, maybe 200,000 barrels more than what the operators are projecting. Am I reading that right?
So, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I think if we look at, maybe I should have mentioned this earlier, if we look at the notes below the chart, so what we see here is an aggregation of the submissions for operators. This excludes the numbers from lessees, you know, designated as explorers by DOR. So these are lessees that are developing projects that are yet to see first oil. So all the projects that we've described that were shown on that map that are yet to see first oil, the operators' numbers there would not include those projects. So while our numbers would include like everything that we generated. So the diversion that you see there is when those new projects start coming in, would expect that you would have more production at that time on the chart. I don't know if that clarifies it.
Follow up?
Yeah, and what are those projects that you're anticipating that is going to create that divergence, that 200,000 more barrels per day in 2031? What are those projects?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. So names of the projects would be projects like, you know, Pika, Willow, all these projects that we mentioned earlier. So the blue line that you see there does not include those projects. So, you know, in time, as those projects begin to come in, you would see that it will fill in, you know, some of the gap that you just alluded to.
And I think to the earlier question, Senator Wilikowski, that I think when we take a look at the forward expectations, we'll, and all oils not being equal, we can try to break that down even further into ownership and interests to make it, you know, a little clearer to everybody, including us. Any other questions on slide number 13? Number 14, please.
So this slide essentially breaks down production into different buckets, like we had described earlier. You know, current production versus production from projects that are under development, and also production from projects that are under evaluation. So the blue section of the chart shows you current production from the fields that we've mentioned earlier, the legacy fields and all the other fields that are currently producing. And as we see, it remains a solid piece of our outlook going out to the 10-year period there. And the projects, the volumes from projects that wells that will be drilled within this fiscal year, we have that in the brown, you know, rust color out up there. Then production from, you know, these major projects that we just described, you know, Pika, Willow, and some of those other projects that are expected to come beyond FY 2022, that production is represented by the gray bar that we see up there. So in general, you see that as you go out into the medium to long term, that portion becomes a very significant piece of the overall outlook for the state. Again, what we generate is a snapshot in time, you know, based on the information that we get from the operators. And as conditions, commercial and economic conditions begin to change, you know, we would see changes in the outlook as well.
Senator Wilson.
I just have a question here under the evaluation. If it begins to play a little bit more of a significant role in the next 5 to 10 years, why does it show up in sort of 2022, 2023, the next year or so?
Sorry, Senator Wilson, I didn't get that.
So if under evaluation, it seems that these several factors, you know, if it's going to be more of a significant role in 5 to 10 years, why is it showing up in next year and the year after?
Oh, I see.
So it just seems that gray under evaluation wouldn't really show a factor in production until a few years out instead of so immediate.
Thank you very much, Senator Wilson, through the chair. I think you raise a good point. The numbers, while that tranche of production plays a bigger role in the future, you know, we should have like really, you know, minor or no volumes, you know, in the first or so fiscal year. So if that's your question, that is something we could take a look at and respond more clearly to. Is that a question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'd also like to have you respond. I'm not, we have a new firm up in Prudhoe, and they're doing a lot of work on enhancing Prudhoe Bay. And there's a lot of oil left in Prudhoe Bay, a lot of prospectivity, and it's very undeveloped. So were you, in your forecast, how are you taking account of the new interest in Prudhoe Bay by, frankly, Hillcorp in their enhancing production out of Prudhoe? And how does that impact your chart here versus the fields that are, you know, hypothetically, you know, to come at us in the future, where we know, as BP said many times, we know where the oil is. It's in Prudhoe. Why should we drill somewhere else? That was their response many times at the table when we asked them why they didn't do exploring and so on and so forth. Help us with the changes in Prudhoe.
So, like you mentioned, the current operator of Prudhoe, just like the operator before that, saw a lot of potential in the asset. And as we continue to discuss with this operator, we through PODs, plans of development, and other technical conversations, they describe what they are seeing, right? They describe some of the areas where the opportunities exist. So the numbers we show here include their outlook for, say, wells that they plan to drill within the next couple years. And we know that there are rigs that exist in these assets. Those rigs will continue to be busy for the next series of years. And for those rigs to be busy, that will be more opportunities within the asset to develop. So, but for us to consider something a project by itself, we look at new pads, for example, in a given area. So if you look at all the projects that we have under the UE category, the under evaluation category, those are like significant standalone or bolt-on projects, you know, associated with different assets. But to your question, we include the outlook within the asset as well, you know, in the numbers that we generate.
Okay. And then just as a quick follow-up, then I'll go to Senator Volkowski. So have you had to increase your expectations for the future out of Prudhoe the last couple of years since we've changed ownership? And what was the marginal difference? And you can get back to us on that. I think it's been a significant change in Prudhoe to the positive.
Correct. And if you look at one of our first slides, we show the growth, I think about 5% growth, you know, by fiscal year in Prudhoe. And that's a significant feat. So we've seen that the things that the operator is doing on the asset, you know, we have positive results as a result of that. And in the first year of operatorship, we saw more of a focus on the facilities and making sure that everything is running well. Now we're seeing more of a shift towards like more drilling and other kinds of well walkovers and other kinds of activities, which have been part of the operator's work. So overall, our outlook for the asset depends on the data that we see. And if you look at our decline rate, possibly back in time, about 4 to 6%, you know, year-on-year decline, that is not what you see today. You know, sometimes you see a flattening, and in some years you see a growth.
And
they were forecasting here at the table in around 2010, I remember 2 or 3% going out a parabolic curve for many decades in Prudhoe, which was much more positive than some of the forecasts of 5 and 6% declines, which seemed to be the previous one seemed to be a much more accurate and very predictable. It's been over a decade, could have drawn these curves out. But don't misinterpret what I'm saying. There's been a change of ownership and a lot of investment and a lot of work. But clearly it was predicted in the age of the field. This would be a normal response to an aging elephant field. It's not abnormal at all. Do you have a question, Senator Wilikowski? You look and you're studying your revenue forecast book.
I'm still trying to understand this, Mr. Chairman, because and I think this is important because I don't want us to get caught in a situation a year down the road or 2 years down the road where, like, all of a sudden we lost 50,000 barrels or 100,000 barrels. And that your undervaluation says it's going to play a significant role in production in 5 to 10 years. And yet, like was previously mentioned, you go out to 2024, 2 years away, and that's, I don't know, 50, 75,000 barrels. 2025, it's probably close to 100,000 barrels. That seems pretty significant to me.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I think that's a fair characterization, and I'll let Pascal supplement this. When that under-evaluation category and under-development category, it certainly includes large fields that we expect to be several years out that will have a large change in production profile. But as Pascal referenced, as Dr. Umekwe referenced, things that were not either in production or being drilled as of June 30th, 2021, are in that category. So something that may be drilled this winter and lead to 5,000, 10,000 barrels of production would be in either that gray or orange bar and start to show up, you know, in that 2023 year. So that category includes, I guess you could say, a spectrum of different kinds of development, some admittedly smaller but nearer term, and some more uncertain but potentially quite large.
So maybe you could help the committee with pick your year to stop, 25 or 2026, substantially shorter than 31, and just break your chart down by field. I think that would help, and then we could see what's in each category, risk-adjusted ourselves here at the table, if we so choose.
Senator,
does it sound reasonable to help understand what's going on?
Yeah.
Senator Stedman, just one note for the committee. We'd be happy to continue to work with you. Some of this information is based on confidential discussions. You know, the operator shares sensitive commercial information and commercial plans, so we do have to be sensitive to.
We're used to that. You could make another category super secret and change the color if you want.
Certainly, sir. Yeah.
Okay. Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski?
So as you know, when a lease is taken out in the state, there's an obligation to develop, explore, produce, if it's reasonably profitable. Are there any leases on the North Slope that the department believes are reasonably profitable that are not being explored or developed or in production?
A loaded question, but go ahead and try.
Yes.
Is there anybody leaving anything on the table?
Well, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, my commissioner hopefully will buzz in and yell at me if I say something I shouldn't.
We can have her answer the question if you're more comfortable.
Commissioner, are you on the line? Would you like to take this one?
Yes, absolutely. And for the record, Corey Feige, DNR commissioner. Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. There are a number of leases that obviously are currently being held by operators who haven't yet commenced exploration work. And all of those leases, as you know, have a primary term. Over the last several years, what the state has done is we have injected terms into those leases that shorten that initial primary term. We've done analysis within the department that demonstrates that in order to get from leasing to first exploration well, it is on the order of about 7 years average time for any company holding leases to get to that exploration phase that then leads to discovery or condemnation, for lack of a better term, of the acreage. And what we've done with that primary term is we've shortened that so that it roughly matches that window, which places a different additional pressure on operators to prioritize that acreage, get on that acreage, and commence exploration before the primary term. And then we have added to it the requirement that there's, first of all, a fairly significant escalation in the annual per acre rent. And then, you know, an applicant or a lessee, rather, can apply for and make a case that they have been doing sufficient work to justify a waiver of that significantly increased rental rate, or they can apply for an extension if they've done no work. They can apply for an extension beyond that primary term of no more than 3 years, which would bring it up to the statutory maximum of 10 years. And it's a pretty high bar to get over. And the whole intent behind all of those mechanisms is to continue to put the pressure on operators and companies to get out and actually work the acreage, acquire seismic data, drill holes, do all of that work that tells, A, the state more about the geology as well as the companies, helps us understand prospectivity, but ultimately employs people and leads to discovery, which can then come online. So a long-winded way of saying we have mechanisms to continue to move companies forward. I do not believe that we have any companies that are, for lack of a better term, warehousing acreage at this point in time.
Okay. Follow-up, Senator Wilkinson?
Could we get a list? I think, you know, we often talk of ourselves as being like the board of directors of this giant oil corporation and as state
Can
legislators.
You speak up a little, I can't.
Yeah, I'd like to see a list, Mr. Chairman. If this were a large corporation, we're sort of like the board of directors, and we would get updates on that, on what's out there, what has been leased, where are we at in various stages of production, development, exploration. I'd like to see a list, Mr. Chairman. I think the committee would benefit from that, of leases that are out, the various stages that they're in, because what I've seen is fields that are extremely profitable. And the over the years, and the feet are being held to the fire, and instead we end up giving out tax breaks, tax deduction, tax credits to incentivize what they should be doing already. So I'd like to see a list. I think that should be provided to the committee, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, or Senator Walikowski, through the chair, the list of lessors is actually available on the Division of Oil and Gas website, and so we've got the list of lessors and their contact information, and then we can endeavor to take a look by company at whether work has been done on those leases or not.
If you could help the committee with that, Madam Commissioner, that would be helpful. Just to put a finer point on it, if we do have an issue or not, and I think the your earlier response, you said on the newer leases, you know, there was clauses put in to encourage development sooner than later. Maybe you can respond to the older leases, also with your inquiry back.
Very good.
Okay. Do we have any other questions on this one? Okay.
Chair, if I could remark on the question that Senator Wilson asked earlier on, I think, the gray portion of that chart. Mm-hmm. So some of the projects we have there would include projects like the GMT-2 that just came online now and Nawal that just came online. So that's why you'd see that gray bar come right to the very beginning.
Okay. Yeah. But you could put that in a format for us and scope it into 2025, 2026, and help us understand that a little bit more.
Okay.
Go on to page 15, and then you guys are out of the hot seat once you finish that.
So on slide 15, we just kind of summarize all what we've talked about earlier. And as we've discussed in the last hour or so, the department continues to work very closely with the Department of Natural Resources, you know, works really closely with the Department of Revenue, you know, in gathering the best quality of information that we can get, you know, on the assets and the projects and what the operators are doing, so as to provide you with numbers that are reliable, numbers that could help you guide the state and the decisions that you make. We do these updates. We do the fall and also the spring. So right now we kicked off the spring project, which will be a review on the 5 months of data that we've received since July of 2021 to see if, you know, that certain assets warrant a second look. For example, we also reach out to the operators to see if they have any new things that have happened in the last couple months that will change their outlook for investments and how their projects will perform. So overall, our forecast for the state for FY 2022 is 500,000 barrels of oil per day, some of that from the North Slope and some of it from a little slice from the cooking lead. And overall, we've said this before, but what we provide is like a snapshot in time a view. And as all the many uncertainties related to projects and how companies allocate capital to what they do, as those change, you know, our outlook also would reflect that new information. I think that's
concludes.
That concludes our presentation. And here is the team that works on this. We send thanks to them.
Questions for you before you
conclude today. Okay.
Well, I guess after the presentation, what can the legislature do, if anything, to assist the Department of Revenue and Department of DNR to get first oil as quickly as possible for some of these oil and gas projects?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I'll let our commissioners supplement. You know, I think we have several pieces of legislation. We'll be speaking to yourself, other members of the committee about this session that we'd appreciate your support and review on. There's a tremendous effort, ongoing effort by the Department of Natural Resources Division of Oil and Gas to actively manage these leases to promote development, you know, under the terms of the leases, but also to seek out new investment, to encourage investment, and to support litigation challenging our leases. So we have a very robust effort underway today through the appropriations and authorities you've already given us. So we appreciate that very much. And I would say, you know, there's a very dynamic global environment for investment, global environment for energy production, very competitive, very uncertain. And so I would just encourage all the members of the committee to continue to follow that very closely and take that into account.
Okay. That concludes any other questions? Committee members. Okay, that concludes the presentation today. And I'd like to thank the department for coming forward presenting today. And then we'll look forward, you know, for you guys to get back to us on that. And then we'll tie that information in with the Department of Revenue. And we may come back with, you know, some more questions as we piece National Resources and Department of Revenue together in the mosaic of what we're dealing with, because it has significant impacts on our ability to close our structural deficit. So the next meeting will be at 1 p.m. today. The committee will hear Senate Bill 9, Alcohol Beverage Control. It's a Title IV rewrite, chaired by Senator Bishop. We'll see everybody here at all committee members. The DNR doesn't have to come. We'll see all committee members and aides here 1 p.m. We are adjourned.
Good afternoon. I call the Senate Finance meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, January 19th, 2022. The time is 1 p.m. Please silence all cell phones. Members today are President Co-Chair Stedman, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Olson, Senator Wilson, and Senator Von Imhoff, and myself, Senator Bishop. I'd like to thank our staff today, support staff, Mr. Jake Wade, Ms. Laura Hosey. Today's agenda, SB 9, Alcoholic Beverage Control, Alcohol Regs, is up today. This is the first hearing of SB 9 in this session. We had an introduction last year of the bill. Our intention is to hear a bill reintroduction, have invited testimony, and set the bill aside. We have the Senate President, Mr. Peter Machicki, here today. Would you like to bring yourself up and Mr. Jackson and give us a reintroduction? Then we're going to go to invited testimony. And with Mr. Lee Ellis, Sarah Oates, Tiffany Hall, and Anna Brawley. So, Senator Machicki, welcome. Mr. Jackson, welcome. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Senator, and the Senate Finance Committee. You may have heard a little something about this bill and this effort over the last couple of years. Considering you seem very similar legislation, and thank you, you've been supportive. I guess I'm going to make it relatively short. Alcohol is a very important industry in Alaska, but it also happens to be a substance that is commonly abused that leads to some difficulties. This bill is about balance, reorganization, and fairness, taking both of those issues into account. It focuses on improved public safety and modernizes our 35-year-old patchwork of statutes into a way that the industry actually operates today. It requires public safety and health accountability, and with the amendment we've discussed in the past, kind of brought all of the various support groups together of all the engaged parties that had stalled the bill in the past. So I've said this in the past, not every bar owner supports every piece of this legislation, but CHAR is supportive of this legislation. Not every manufacturer supports this legislation, every piece of it, but the Brewers Guild supports it. And there are some in public safety who would like to see other things in the bill, but Recover Alaska, the troopers in the past, and PSEA has supported this bill as well as AMCO. There's a reason for that. It's about balance. It recognizes what's important about the industry, and that's not only entertainment and lodging and the cruise industry, but it also puts effectiveness into enforcement. We had a one-size-fits-all before. This takes into account the different sizes, and it largely lets healthy operators continue to operate the way they normally have, but it puts some teeth into the laws that will correct some of the less productive operators, if you will. So I want to emphasize that this is not something that was done in a vacuum. You've been here for the years and thousands of hours working with public safety, public health, the industry, the ABC board, and the legislature. You've all taken a part in sharpening this bill to the point where it is today. It promotes a fair business climate, protects public health and safety. It limits alcohol, youth access to alcohol. It works to control the distribution of alcohol in places where the distribution is either problematic or illegal. It promotes responsible alcohol use and reduce the harms of overconsumption. It implements change without negatively harming existing businesses and responsible operators. And it dramatically expands local control for municipalities. So this doesn't move us away from the three-tier system, separation of manufacturers, wholesalers, and retailers to prevent monopolies. But it moves into a very creative and probably one of the things I'm most proud of. Businesses will have the opportunity through licensing, permits, and endorsements to operate the way the alcohol industry operates today. And that's what's missing in our hodgepodge of Title IV. It completely reorganizes that, but it allows the industry to operate the way that it operates today. And I think that's probably the most important part, aside from the public health and safety aspects. So we have invited testimony today. I'll, of course, be here for questions. I appreciate this being the bill that you're taking up early very much. I think you know that. And I will just stand by and listen to our invited testimony and see what kind of questions you have. So thank you.
All right. Thank you for that. Now we're going to go to the next part of our agenda, and that is for the in-person invited testimony. Mr. Lee Ellis, you'd bring yourself to the table, please, and introduce yourself for the record and start with your testimony.
For the record, my name is Lee Ellis, and I am the president of the Brewers Guild of Alaska. Brewers Guild of Alaska represents over 40 breweries, wineries, cider makers, and meaderies throughout the state. We employ over 2,000 employees statewide and have an economic impact of over $330 million. I definitely want to thank the committee today for hearing this bill and hearing this bill early. This is an extremely important bill to us. As you may imagine, our industry has been affected significantly by COVID-19 and other economic impacts related to it. And this bill is a very critical part to our recovery in the next few years. It helps streamline regulations. It helps give brewery businesses a much clearer road and pathway to opening and starting new businesses. And we are absolutely supportive of it. We have been a stakeholder since the very beginning and have helped with this process the entire way. And we are very happy with the status of this bill and the way it is written today. So thank you very much for your time. And if you have any questions, I am here.
Thank you. Looking at the table, I don't see any questions at the present time. Thank you for your testimony. And next, Ms. Sarah Oates, I believe, here is in person and ready to present as well. And if you'd put yourself on the record, please.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Oates. I'm the president and CEO of Alaska Char, which is the state's nonprofit trade association for the hospitality industry, representing over 800 bars, restaurants, hotels, and other hospitality businesses statewide. I first would like to extend my sincere appreciation to this committee for hearing this bill so early in session this year. This is a really critical piece of legislation for our industry. We have entered the 11th year of robust stakeholder work toward meaningful, sensible alcohol regulatory reform, which I have personally been involved in since the beginning. I'm very proud to say that through challenging yet thoughtful compromise, consensus on a complete draft was finally reached in 2019 between public health, public safety, state and municipal regulatory bodies, and all three industry tiers. Alaska Char proudly offers our support of Senate Bill 9, and I implore the committee to swiftly pass this vital legislation, as it will provide long-term regulatory certainty and desperately needed financial stability for the industry. We are now 2 years into this pandemic, and liquor licensees have suffered devastating blows. That's no secret to any of you. Our constituency represents $2 billion of annual revenue into Alaska and over 32,000 employees. In 2020 alone, our industry statewide experienced average revenue losses of 75% and only had 40% of their regular employee count actually working. Significant losses and hardships continue to our industry today, which may not be as glaringly apparent, but businesses are very much hurting right now. Senate Bill 9 includes many changes that would benefit all sectors and stakeholders, and it gives our industry some hope that we can overcome ongoing challenges, move forward with a better regulatory system, and again thrive as part of Alaska's second largest industry. I thank you all for your time and consideration and respectfully ask that you advance this bill quickly. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? Seeing none, thank you. And next, we're going to go to our off-net, those calling in. And I believe we have Ms. Tiffany Hall from Recover Alaska. Ms. Hall, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, could you give us just a second? We're going to get the sound dialed up a little bit. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thanks very much. My name is Tiffany Hall. I'm the executive director of Recover Alaska. We're a statewide organization made up of leaders in health, safety, and prevention that worked to reduce excessive alcohol use and harms across the state. Thank you so much, Co-Chairs Bishop and Stedman, and all of the members of the committee for considering SB 9 and the speed with which this hearing was scheduled. You are much appreciated. I am testifying in support of SB 9. We have been working on the content of SB 9 for many years, hand in hand with other public health and safety proponents, as well as members of the alcohol industry at every level, and local, municipal, and community leaders. Recover Alaska is not an abstinence-only organization, but as you likely know, Alaska struggles with many problems associated with alcohol. We are dying at rates over twice as high as the national average. Alcohol costs our state $2.4 billion every year, which includes criminal justice, health care, lost productivity, traffic collisions, and social services. We support the passage of SB 9 for all of the positive health and safety provisions included, which are largely evidence-based practices that will work to reduce underage drinking, increase public safety by reducing alcohol-related violence and crime, and will reduce alcohol-related deaths. This bill also makes Title IV clearer to understand and enforce for licensees and the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, and will promote public health and safety. We have worked long and hard over the years with more than 120 stakeholders representing various sectors, issues, and regions of the state. We argued, we listened, and we worked hard together to find solutions we can all agree on. The bill overall will be a huge win for the state of Alaska. Thank you again for your time and consideration, and I respectfully ask you to please pass SB 9 out of committee and out of the Senate. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. We'll take a brief of these. Okay, we're back on the record under invited testimony. We're going to go to Mr. Glenn Klinkhart, Director of Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. Are you there, sir?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can, sir. Thank you.
Please, put yourself on the record, and if you'd like to add to the invited testimony, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. My name is Glenn Edward Klinkhart, and I am honored to be the director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office and to be here today. Thank you. In fact, I'm actually here in Juneau for our board meetings. They let me sneak out so I could speak, so thank you all very much for your time. Just two big things I'd like to just add to the mix. Number one, the Alcohol Beverage Control Office has consistently every year supported the rewrite from the office standpoint and from the board, and they asked me to let you know that they are still in favor of this because of all the things that have been mentioned before, not just by industry, but also public health. The other thing I'd like to add is that after spending some time getting to know the bill, look at the bill, I actually became kind of jealous because there were these things like the fine schedules, things that can actually help for the lower level things, be able to get people to fall into compliance, to people who make minor mistakes, be able to fix it. And yet, for the more serious things, such as providing alcohol to our children, those sort of things, there are still very stiff penalties that I, as a law enforcement officer, I've spent 25 years as a law enforcement officer here in Alaska, that I was very sensitive to what this bill was going to do. That being said, one of the things I just wanted to add is that I was so impressed that I actually stole the fine schedule and the whole concept of some of this, and we've actually started in the last year to have this same sort of process in marijuana, which really didn't have anything. And I'm happy to say that as of today, we actually have a fine schedule that was developed in a very similar way with the industry, one that allows for folks who make minor mistakes to pay their fine, to move on, learn from it. And just in the last 2 days, we've had several people that have come before the board who had just that and made a mistake. They learned from it, and we don't expect to see them again. And yet, if you do have people, that small percentage in law enforcement, we like to say that 5% causes 95% of the problem. The system is designed for us to be able to see that. And if people don't make changes and don't get better, or they continue to put the public at risk, there's things that we can do. So I'm very happy that I was introduced to Title IV. I was able to take some of the things and actually implement them over on the marijuana side. And myself and my officers were really eager to see this be available on the alcohol side. And I am available for any questions if you like.
Thank you. Do I see any questions from committee members for Mr. Klinkhardt? Seeing none, thank you, sir, for your testimony, and it's greatly appreciated. Next, we are at close of our invited testimony for today. And if members have any questions of the bill sponsor, Mr. Jackson, they're here. We can bring them back up to the table. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, this might be for someone online, but just a couple questions have come up from people. And the first one is, and I think I know the answer, I just want to get on the record, but the first one is regarding the keg registration section. Section 134, page 103, makes it a $100 fine for anyone possessing an unregistered keg with alcohol in it. And I'm just curious, just want to clarify the application to homebrewers who use kegs.
Thank you.
For personal use.
Senator Machicki, you want a lifeline or you got it?
Well, I'll touch on it, and then I'd like Lee from the Brewers Guild to touch on it as well. I want to clarify that this does not create regulated usages where they don't currently exist. So if you're a home brewer, you're not a licensee, it's not a regulated activity, and it's the same on the I had your other question on the bottle club question. This is designed specifically for licensees and for distribution and not for what's currently legal today. I've done a little bit of brewing myself, and I understand the implications if of you wanting it clarified on the record, so I'll hand it off to Lee to touch on it as well.
Mr. Ellis, if you'd reintroduce yourself for the record.
For the record, Lee Ellis, Brewers Guild of Alaska. I think that's a great question. And it's a great concern, and I'm glad to hear that the home brewers are of concern to this committee. As far as the kegs, they are registered upon sale, and further clarity will be provided during the regulatory process. So, of course, there's statute, and then for the finer details, I believe regulation can solve those questions. But the goal of that is to make sure that if underage persons are in possession of a keg, the person who supplied it will be held accountable for that. So I would not see this necessarily being an issue for home brewers with their own personal supply at home.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
Okay, so then the next question is on the bottle club and whether the provision, page 96, section 111, whether that impacts, again, home brewers as well.
I'm happy to touch on that. I'd actually like for Anna to answer that. I know the answer, but she has such a wealth of knowledge, and she's very helpful. So if Ms. Brawley can touch on that, that would be helpful.
Ms. Brawley, did you hear the question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I can hear.
Please put yourself on the record and answer the question, please.
Yes, thank you. For the record, my name is Anna Brawley. I'm the Title IV Review Coordinator here in Anchorage. And in response to your question through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, basically a bottle club, my understanding is that's an enforcement statute that deals with a situation where somebody has an establishment, say, you know, they're calling it a club or a bar or whatever,
and they don't have a license, and they just store alcohol on site, basically getting around the idea that you would need a license to operate an establishment like that. And so this would not apply to, say, a private event where folks get together. It's not open to the public. It's simply a social event.
Okay.
Senator Wilkowski.
And while I got you on the line, if I could just ask you, are you familiar with the keg registration issue? I just a little unclear about the last answer I heard. Can we say definitively to homebrewers, you're not going to have to register your kegs, or is that sort of up in the air at this point?
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. No, my understanding is that somebody using a keg for personal use would not not need to register, because the situation where that would apply is if, say, a law enforcement officer comes across an underage party, and then, you know, the tag clearly was from a package store but was removed. It's an enforcement mechanism and not something proactively that folks would be enforcing in people's homes.
Okay, thank you. And then if I could, just one last question, Mr. Chairman. And it's something I got from someone in a smaller community who said that currently towns with 12,000 people are authorized to have four brewery tap rooms. And under this draft, it would limit it to one brewery tap room and one winery tasting room. And I just figured, thought I'd ask the question to whoever might know the answer to that and the rationale for that.
Ms. Brawley? Senator Machicki?
Yeah, I'm happy to answer that. I have personally spoken to that individual many times. And as I stated earlier, the Brewers Guild is in support of the bill, but not every single person supports every aspect. So the sort of negotiation that the Brewers ended up supporting includes many pieces. One is a soft close at 8 to a hard close at 10, so they would enjoy that. And speaking to that, this person, they're in support of all of those other things. This would not eliminate existing businesses. If they are in place, they are in place. So there would be new limits from the 1 in 12,000 that was previously 1 in 9,000 in past bill versions. And then, of course, they'd also be able to have events, four permitted through the board, community activities. And if you remember the discussion years ago when fun wasn't allowed and there were attempts, a significant regulation package that resulted in 1,200 pages of public testimony against, we don't have that level of opposition. But some people are going to be worried that it's going to limit the future growth. And that may be something that the legislature has to discuss in the future if there is that kind of growth. But this does not close down businesses because of the limits.
Thank you. Senator Wilson.
Yeah, I think Senator Machicki just touched on a little bit on this, was that some of the concerns that we had was, does this create new barriers to entry upon to prevent new brewers from entering or any other industry as a growing industry within our region of the valley? Will we see more Senate Bill 9 sort of create a limited entry situation with this piece of legislation?
It will create a limited entry situation. Now, in the future, you may have to discuss what that balance looks like. But this was what was negotiated that gave room for growth. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I should have waited for your request for me to answer that question.
Oh, that's fine. This is the first shakedown cruise for the chairman. He's taking notes right now, so.
Okay.
It
will. That's how most of the industry works. It does. It leaves room for growth today. And the reason for this bill is to sort of completely rewrite a title that doesn't work for today's industry. This sets it with some room for growth, taking into account the fact that the brewing and distilling industry is growing, and that's something we may have to reevaluate in the future. But it resets it to today's conditions and allows room for growth.
Thank you. Other questions from committee members? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen, and thanks for the questions, good questions. And our next meeting is tomorrow, January 20th at 2022. Chair Stedman will be back in control of the agenda at 9 a.m. And we are adjourned.